Hey guys, it's Ananya and welcome back to the Desi Reality. Today I have a very, very special guest with us today. She's a culturally responsive clinical psychologist, speaker, and global resource on racial and social equity trauma. Let's welcome Dr. Anjali Ferguson to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited to be talking to you. So guys, Dr. Ferguson and her husband just authored a book. It was designed to be a conversation starter for families about race. So many South Asians, as we all know, have experienced emotional trauma, including colorism, body image, racial inequality, and subconscious bias. So this book addresses all of that. And I'm super excited to talk about the book too. So let's just jump right into the questions. So Dr. Ferguson, tell us more about your book. What is it all about?
Sure. Yeah. It is a children's book. It's titled An Ordinary Day. And my husband and I just had the idea to write this really in just our nighttime conversations when we were putting our son down. We would talk about all the children's books that he had in his library. And so my son was born in 2019 and he's a bit of a pandemic baby. He was born towards the end of the pandemic. So that racial reckoning that we had as a country in 2020 was really prevalent when he was in his infancy and we were building his library. And my husband is a Black man. And so conversations about race and culture and identity come up a lot in our lives, just how we kind of navigate the world. And what we are recognizing was that in children's books, there aren't enough resources or stories that really address these conversations. And as somebody who studies culture, studies cultural identity and mental health impacts, it's something I know we need to do in childhood. But again, we don't have resources. So that's how the book kind of came to be.
I love that. I think it's really important to identify the little things that impact us in our childhood, whether that's skin color as a crayon or whether that's a child's book. So I think that's amazing. And I genuinely think that is creating true change starting at the beginning of where the problem starts. So that's awesome.
Thank you. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. We're a little bit more about the book too, so that the audience understands the premise, but it basically follows two little boys throughout their day, two little boys in kindergarten on their first day of school. One is a white boy and one is a Black boy. And it shows really nuanced differences in the same exact interaction that each of them are going through. And those nuances really talk to or speak to implicit bias, coloristic kinds of issues, racism, systemic disadvantages, and how all of that over the course of one day and all the microaggressions that somebody experiences over a lifetime can then really compound and impact mental health. So you don't see it impacting the child's mental health in the story, but we offer a lot of conversation starters at the end of the book for parents to engage with their kiddos in so that they can better kind of understand those nuanced differences.
That's awesome. And so that kind of leads me into my next question. This is obviously something that a lot of POC will deal with. It's our reality. It's what we go through. Is there something specific that sparked your passion to write this book in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have been a trauma therapist, done early childhood trauma work for most of my career. And I've been with my partner now for over a decade and a half. And I thought I understood like racism and discrimination, even with like the work that I did, I thought I understood it. But until I really started to get to know my family members, my in-laws, and having deeper conversations with my husband, and then Michael Brown's death in 2005 was a bit of an awakening for me to recognize that I actually don't know what racism and discrimination looks like in this country, even though I'm a woman of color and I've grown up in like pretty diverse areas. The Black experience and those of other historically marginalized groups is just so different from even those of us that are South Asian. And it was a bit of an eye-opener for me and an unlearning and relearning process for me. And I really started committing myself to social equity work then. But then in 2019, I had my son, and being the mom of a Black child was another layer that I needed to consider in terms of my lack of understanding of his world experiences, what he's going to experience in the world. And so I became even more kind of impassioned into making sure people started having these conversations early, because kids really notice like race-based differences as early as 6 months of age, and then become pretty set in those racial biases by the time they're 2 and 4 years old. So that felt like not a lot of time for us to start conversations with little ones. So that my why is really like my husband and my son is why we sat down and that like needed to get this done.
I think that's awesome. So just, you know, out of curiosity, why a book? Like, was there something that sparked your passion specifically to write this kind of book?
Yeah. I mean, I work with children a lot in my work. Most of my time is with children and families clinically, and we use books a lot. Like, I mean, books are a huge like resource we tap into for everything, whether it's in the therapy world, whether we want to like gift somebody something when a kid is born. They're just huge conversation starters, where books are just such a wealth of knowledge. And it's this like concrete thing in people's hands, right? Like, I think what we started seeing in 2020 was a lot of conversations started happening. People are actually sitting down and like thinking through and having discussions, but almost always in my workshops and trainings, people would leave and ask me, well, how? Like, how do we do this, right? Like, you're telling me that we need to have conversations about race. You're telling me we need to understand what equity and microaggressions look like, but how do we do that with children? How is kind of how I got to my how. So the book just felt like a really concrete resource.
I love that. So that's actually exactly leading into the next question too, which is, how does this book specifically empower children to have conversations about race? How does that go about?
Yeah, I think we do it in this like really subtle way. So like I said, it follows two boys throughout an average day in their lives. And it's not a hit you in the face with the differences necessarily, or hit you in the face with topics during the story, but it's so subtle that you still notice these differences in each boy's day. And at the end, we give some prompts for families and how to start these conversations with kids. So something as simple as, hey, did you notice any differences between the two boys? What did you see? Was there one boy's day you'd prefer over the other? Why? Which one? And just getting you to have a discussion with your child. And then as they start to talk with you about those differences, we also give a little bit of glossary of terms of, what is a microaggression? How can you explain that to a child? What does privilege mean? How do you explain that to a child? So really kind of elementary basic terms and how to do that, so that parents can literally have the conversation with the child after they've read the book. And so my son is almost 3. And when we read the book together, I even do it with him. I'll look at the 2 pages and I'll say, hey, which do you like Logan's day here or Malik's day more? And he'll point to which one he likes and I'll ask him why, and he'll tell me why. So it's all about intentionality on the parent's part. And sometimes as adults, we don't even know what to ask, right? And so that's how towards the end of the book, we try and help you with those.
I really like that. I think there's so many ways that we're told we can create change, but having something that really walks you through it on such a specific yet important level is really important. And I genuinely think that that's amazing. So kudos to you. I think that's an amazing idea. So that's awesome.
Thank you.
Of course. Thank you. So obviously, as we were talking about this earlier, but being Black is something that is very, very different when you live in America versus being another kind of POC. That's not to say that other POC don't have their own experiences, but that is to say that Black people do tend to go through specific, I guess you could say, microaggressions or obstacles that a lot of other POC don't have to go through, or at least not at the level that they do. However, that doesn't mean that our background does not change the way that we see the world. So growing up, I know you're Indian. So how did being Indian affect you, your growth, your mental health, and how you perceive the world today?
Yeah, absolutely. Great point, right? Like, I think many times in these conversations about race, it becomes this like oppression, like bidding battle of some sort of like who's been oppressed more or longer. And that really takes away from the messaging that like many movements like the Black Lives Matter movement are trying to purport. So it's important for us to recognize that, sure, we as South Asians have also experienced our own oppressions, but they are just unequivocally different from the systemic racism that historically marginalized groups like Black and Indigenous communities have experienced in this country because of the centuries of enslavement and all sorts of other things. But my specific journey, because I do have, experienced microaggressions and discrimination throughout my career and my life. For me being Indian, so I grew up outside of the DC area, which is a pretty diverse area, racially and culturally, not so much socioeconomically. So you don't realize that until you leave the DC area. So I grew up there, and then my family actually moved back to India mm-hmm. when I was about 8 years old. So I had been really acculturated to Western American society, and then I was plucked out of here and plopped into Bangalore and boarding school for 2 years, and that was a culture shock.
Yeah,
it was different. And that is where I feel like I really started to be like, whoa, cultural differences are a thing and they exist. And yes, I was young, but it was a stark enough difference that it stuck with me. So seeing and living in India as a child for a few years and then eventually moving back here, that was a huge turning point in my life. And like I said, there's just very different experiences, lived experiences in India. And then those of us here in America are of a privileged group as well. So when I'm talking about South Asians, like it requires a certain amount of financial means to be able to immigrate here and live here. So those of us that live here are of a privileged like caste and all sorts of other things that come into play when we're speaking to Indian oppressive systems too. We moved back to the DC area. And then of course I met my husband pretty soon after. We met pretty young. But all of those experiences for me really shaped my cultural identity development. And I talk about cultural identity because our culture and our identity with our culture really impacts our mental health, because there are different stages of identity development where if you're more secure in your identity, you're less anxious, less depressed, less likely to have mental health challenges, because you can kind of navigate the traditional culture that you're from as well as navigating American culture or majority culture. So that journey though can take folks an entire lifetime to achieve. And it's a real like intentional process of being able to say, well, what about my history and my heritage is meaningful for me that I want to make sure I like am prideful in and like embrace? And then what aspects of Western society do I need to also embrace so that I can balance the two worlds?
Right.
And I would say it wasn't until I was well into my 30s until I could feel like pretty confident mm-hmm. in what my cultural identity was and how that impacted my mental health.
Absolutely. I think that is a very common struggle that a lot of us have. It's just imposter syndrome, and it's hard to find that perfect balance for you. I think everyone has their own unique balance too. So it's hard to follow yeah. someone's lead, and you have to find the perfect balance for you. And it takes time sometimes. So you're absolutely right. Yes. And so connecting this back into the book, coming from such an interesting background, going back to India and being in America, having that culture shock, how have your specific experiences from your ethnic background impacted the way you formed this book?
Yeah. I feel like we are still on this like emerging cusp of South Asian representation. It's been wonderful. These last several years, we are certainly seeing more of it and embracing who we are in our heritage and our traditions. But it still feels like there's so much more work to be done, right? You can never have overrepresentation in my mind of like marginalized communities like ours. And so while like this specific book doesn't necessarily represent a South Asian experience, the themes of equity and discrimination kinds of issues are just so central to like the work that I do and how I think because of my life experiences have shaped my worldview, that it is integral to anything I'm putting out, really, content-wise, work-wise, product-wise. So yeah, does that answer that?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's perfect. And so just for our listeners, because I know I want to read the book, where can people purchase this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it is available on Amazon. And then if you're in the Richmond area, it's going to be Richmond, Virginia area. It's going to be available at a few brick and mortar children's stores as well soon.
That's awesome. Awesome, yeah. Awesome. Okay, so everyone stop what you're doing and go order it from Amazon right now. Yeah, okay, perfect. So now I want to get to know a little bit more about you, because this is something that is very intriguing. I feel like it's hard to be able to find someone who's had such vast experiences. So being someone who is in medicine and also having such a diverse background and, you know, obviously, as you said, having several culture experiences, what is your experience as a South Asian woman in medicine? Did you ever experience that imposter syndrome during your journey to practicing, and how did that go about?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I am in medicine and I am a psychologist too, which adds an extra layer, because many times I've been asked why I'm not a quote real doctor by many members of the community. And to every other practicing psychologist or people who want to become a psychologist, you very much so are a real doctor. So, you know, be proud of what you're doing. But imposter syndrome, I mean, every single day, I wish I could say it goes away, but despite everything I've accomplished and everything I continue to do, I still have many moments that I sit there and say, can I say this? Can I do this? Like, who am I to say these things? Right. And I have literal cover, like as of this weekend, I was talking to my husband about something and I was like, I can't do this. And he's like, yeah, you can, like, you're Dr. Ferguson. And it's like a constant reminder of I can. So the imposter syndrome never goes away. You just kind of learn to work through it. And I think a part of why that imposter syndrome never goes away is because of how we were raised too. I mean, if we talk about like themes that are so common in South Asian women, especially upbringing, right? Perfectionism, like high achievement, making sure that we are appeasing everybody around us before ourselves, like our needs come second. All of that is still so deeply rooted in me, despite me like, you know, breaking cycles and changing like the narrative and all of that. I still have moments of these like insecurities within me because of how I was raised. So I say all of that to say, like, I see you feeling the imposter syndrome. I feel it too. I see you experiencing the insecurities. I do too. Like, there's not a day that I don't second guess the things that I'm saying and doing. But with that, I also say, if we don't start being more assertive, if we don't start breaking cycles, like also uplifting other women in our society, really praising and pioneering the work of other women in our society, then we're not going to get anywhere if we keep it competitive and we keep it like insular too. So a big part of what I do too is also making sure we're not just having conversations with ourselves as South Asian community members, but also like talking to other communities and being present and embracing other groups too, because in order for other people to embrace us, we have to embrace them too. So long-winded answer, but yes, I still experience it. And it's a journey. I mean, not only are you gonna experience discrimination from a standpoint of people feeling like you shouldn't be outspoken or you shouldn't have ideas because you should be passive and submissive in the medical system too. Like just be a workhorse, keep your head down and keep it moving. So when you do start to use your voice, people get taken aback too, right? But your voice is so important and so necessary that if we don't utilize it, people will never hear us.
Absolutely. I think that is so true. I actually was listening to an interview done by a very famous Bollywood actress. Her name's Sonam Kapoor. And she was talking about how we are inevitably kind of built to be desirable as South Asian women. And everything you do is for desirability, whether it's how you look, whether it's how you dress, whether it's what career you have. A lot of South Asian mindsets will just expect women to be desirable at the end of the day. Yeah. And there's so much more than that. When you pursue a career, it's more than just a certificate that makes you desirable. And, you know, as you were saying earlier, we're meant to, you know, appease, but we're more than that. And I think it's really important to emphasize that we are more than that. And, you know, obviously being in medicine, I'm sure you've dealt with experiences where people have second-guessed you. And, you know, I'm sure that was something very, very hard to go, you know, or deal with. So how have you dealt with situations like that in the past as well?
Yeah, I mean, constantly, right? It's if you provide an opinion that might be counter to what that person is expecting of you, then it's really quick for them to challenge your expertise and and that, I think for us, especially in South Asian communities, it's easy to internalize that critique, right? Or internalize that pushback and say, oh, maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, and like really beat down on ourselves. And it happens a lot in the mental health field because many times you can't see a lot of mental illness, right? So it's different from like diagnosing a broken arm or a, you know, some other physical ailment that you can see. Mental health requires like a level of training that we can see these internal processes, but it's also easy for people to then like refute what you're saying because there's nothing like visible to or concrete to like see in front of them. So you're going to come across that a lot. It's this level of just like assertiveness in feeling confident and knowing that what you are the expert in that room, you know what you're talking about, and being firm and placing your boundaries there too. And then the people pleasing part of it is like, I don't like when a patient or another medical provider doesn't agree with my opinion, right? Like, I feel like I did something wrong. And it's just kind of learning to be like, well, this is what I see. And then the family or you are welcome to a second opinion, or you can go elsewhere too. And just being firm in your boundary setting, which is really hard for us to do as South Asian women, I think, too. Our boundaries just kind of get really, I don't know, sometimes they don't even exist because we don't prioritize ourselves. But it's a constant, like you said, it's not like the journey ends when you get that degree. It's an uphill battle for us just throughout, even though we are overrepresented as South Asians in medical settings. It's still in certain medical settings, I should say, because in mental health, we're still underrepresented. But even though we are overrepresented in those settings, it's also still really quick to kind of second guess us.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that kind of leads us into our closing question here, because there's a lot of people who are going to be listening in because they want to know more about either the book or about your own experience as a woman in medicine. So do you have any other advice for listeners hoping to pursue a medical profession, advocacy, or both as someone who comes from a South Asian background or an ethnic background?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is becoming firm in who you are. Right? If you can figure out who you are, then you can be clear about what your boundaries are or what you're willing to take and not take and stick to it, right? And whoever you are and your identity is, it's going to be different from the next person. No two South Asian women are the same. You know, we are both sitting here as South Asian women. Both of us still have a lot of differences and intersectionalities in our identity too. And it's embracing those differences and making sure we kind of stay true to us. In doing so, with the advocacy piece too, is also being open to differences and open to alternative perspectives, right? And along with that comes, in knowing our cultural identities, also learning what our privileges are, because in order for us to actually do meaningful change when it comes to advocacy, we have to recognize our privileges and then be able to be willing to give up certain things, because that's just what the work comes down to, is when you see what your privileges are, you utilize them, and then you need to be willing to give certain things up for true equitable change.
Yeah. I think that's very real advice. And I think that's the most applicable advice people can use. So I appreciate that. Thank you so much for your time today. And thank you so, so much for coming on. I'm so excited I had the opportunity to speak with you. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm just thrilled to be here, and I appreciate you talking with me today.
Of course, of course. And to all the listeners listening in, be sure to check out Dr. Ferguson's book. And also, as you guys know, I say this every single time, make sure to eat food, drink water, and take care of yourself, because you deserve it. I hope you guys have an amazing day. And once again, thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Ferguson.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.